Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us on this Friday. Climate change is causing more rain in many parts of the U.S., and more rain means more flooding. That's bad news for one Great Lakes region crop, wild rice. NPR's Rebecca Hersher has this story.
Northern wild rice, real wild rice, grows naturally in rivers and lakes all over Wisconsin, Minnesota, Michigan, and into Canada. And harvesting it is a group activity, especially in native communities.
This is a family homestead. Yep.
The Couture family is part of the Ojibwe tribe. They live on the Bad River near Lake Superior, and Chris Couture remembers when he was a kid, lots of people would come harvest near their house.
You know, back in the day, you come out here during racing time, and everyone came here. Everyone brought their boats. I mean, every canoe was lined up a whole way.
But the climate is changing, and some people here say it seems to be hurting the wild rice plants.
That used to just be filled with rice, and now there's not rice there anymore.
Dylan Jennings works for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. He personally harvests wild rice every year.
But our elders always talk about how lush and how just pristine all the wild rice used to be in our area here, and how thick it was. But nowadays, where I'm coming from as a young person, over the last few years, we've seen major flooding in the area. We've seen other environmental things that have come into play.
Things like a longer growing season, as climate change causes average temperatures to rise. Ecologists warn that a longer growing season may sound like good news, but wild rice has adapted to a shorter growing season. Longer summers actually favor other plants and let them crowd out wild rice. And then there's the flooding. There are more frequent and severe rainstorms in the upper Midwest. Floodwater carries sediment and pollution into the rice beds. Preliminary studies suggest that the cumulative effects of climate change are leading to more bad years for local rice harvests. Dylan Jennings says that's particularly hard on Ojibwe people in the region.
Wild rice is always used in all of our ceremonies and all of our gatherings, and so, you know, we're dependent upon that. It can be really tough.
As climate change continues, good growing areas for the wild rice plants will be farther north, but the people who rely on it won't be able to follow. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
Dylan Jennings is a tribal council member with the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and Emily Nellis works on traditional ecological knowledge with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. The two sat down with me during last week's Manoman Powwow at Bad River to talk about wild rice and its significance to Anishinaabe people.
Bonjour, my name is Bija Keens, or Dylan Jennings.
My name is Minogija Gukwe. And my other name is Emily Nellis.
So within our migration story and within that prophecy, our ancestors were told to, you know, come to the place where food grew on water, where it literally grew on water. And this is this place here, and in particular Moniwinnikaunee, Madeline Island, and this whole area is one of those final stopping points for our people. And we found that Manoomin growing all over the place in these areas, you know, not only on the inland lakes, but we have a really, you know, really beautiful and intricate wetland estuary here, one of the most beautiful and one-of-a-kind places for wetlands and probably the whole region. And so in this particular area, the Manoomin actually grows right on the river here, on the Bad River, and it grows out into this area called the Bad River Sloughs. And in that area, that's where the river begins to empty into Gitche-Gumee or Lake Superior. And so it's a very, very sacred and beautiful area, an area of significance for Anishinaabe people and especially for our Bad River people here.
How have things changed for wild rice over time, you know, since you were young and the way things are now?
So I started harvesting rice when I was a young man. We grew up all over the place as a young person, and so one of the big things was to make it back home here for ricing season, you know, and this time of the year, early late August, and we'd make it back and go ricing with my cousins and whatnot, and even then, you know, I'm not very old, but I can remember, you know, a lot of the rice beds being more lush and more, you know, rice more plentiful in areas and thick. Out in the Bad River Sloughs, and you know, just growing up and listening to a lot of the stories from our elders talk about it. They talk about certain areas out there being even you know, greater expanses of rice than what they are now. You know, we face a lot of you know, limiting factors that have sometimes eliminated manumen in certain areas and also made it a little bit more sparse. But that's what we continually hear around here. You know, a lot of our elders talk about that. You know, they talk about areas like, oh, you know, up by Big Round, up by Big Slough, used to be way thick, you know, really, really thick, full of rice there. You know, you could just, you know, sit your canoe in there and you could rice there all day and your canoe would just be filled, you know. And nowadays sometimes we struggle to find the rice the way it used to be a long time ago.
So what's impacting that? You know, what are some of the things that are challenging wild rice in the area?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, and we should let her comment on this too, but there's a lot of outside factors that we consider all, you know, climactic in general. You know, climate change has been we feel, one of the big contributors for, you know, introduction of and the thriving of invasive species, other species that compete with manumen. Some of the severe weather that we've received, from the flooding to, you know, to the other, you know, environmental things that have been happening, you know, water levels are a big thing. You know, if the water is too high, if it's too low, the wild rice is a very delicate plant in that it needs really specific conditions to thrive. And so it has various stages, and one of those stages is like the floating leaf stage, when that plant is really vulnerable at that point in time and before it begins to really take its roots down and grow upwards. And so, you know, any kind of variance in water levels, temperature, and even water movement can have drastic impacts upon the manumen.
So, Emily, you're working on the traditional ecological knowledge of wild rice. Mm-hmm. So tell me about the work that you're doing and how that plays into the season we're coming up on now.
So actually, I just joined Glyphwick about 3 months ago, so I'm fairly new. And our wild rice plan has actually been in the works for much longer than I've been on the team for. But I have been going through a lot of various data to incorporate into these certain plans, so more specific traditional stories and language and just general knowledge from our tribal harvesters and knowledge holders to incorporate more into these plans, to more infuse into the biological aspect and the taxonomy and ecology of manumen itself as a resource document for essentially everybody who is interested in manumen.
Can you tell me traditionally how the tribe or tribes in the area have gone about growing wild rice or taking care of it and cultivating the resource?
Yeah, so we're always taught, like when we're out ricing, to let some of that rice fall back into the water, to aid, you know, reseeding efforts. And I know that some harvesters have actually gone out to specific lakes where maybe it's not growing anymore or it's really sparse, and done a lot of reseeding themselves, just throwing some of that rice seed back into the water to help it grow.
For either of you, how do tribal members here at Bad River go out right now and harvest wild rice?
We get out to the sloughs, and usually everyone, for the most part, rices with a partner. You have a partner, and, you know, it's pretty, it's a really beautiful thing because you think about it, you know, it's one of those practices where, you know, it's really important to depend upon and rely upon another person, you know, and that's like a teamwork thing. And you have your partner, and many people have their partners that they've had for a long, long time, you know, since they were little kids, you know, and some of our elders are still ricing with their same partners, and they go out there, and one person is using the pole, the ricing pole, to pull through the rice. It's called a push pull. And so they they use that push pole to push through the rice, and then another person is sitting in the canoe, and in our language we say bawa'um, you know, knocking rice into the canoe. And so one of the things that, you know, as far as equipment goes, we use these ricing sticks that are made of cedar. You know, they're nice, they're lightweight because they're made of cedar, they're dried. And one of the I guess teachings behind that is that those sticks are light, and the way that we utilize them in this sweeping motion on the minumen doesn't damage the minumen. It just lightly knocks those grains into the canoe. And so you're not out there hacking the rice. You're out there just lightly knocking those rice grains into your canoe and moving on down. And like Emily was talking about, you know, rice gets knocked back into the water and that recedes for us.
So does Bad River do any reseeding aside from that right now because of the way things have been going, where you've seen less rice?
Absolutely. You'll find that a lot of tribes are really active in reseeding of wild rice on, you know, lakes within the reservation boundaries and even lakes outside of the reservation boundaries within the ceded territory. A lot of tribes have you know, traditional ricing grounds in areas where they've harvested for a long time, and they really do try to maintain and keep those areas as well as they possibly can as minumen, you know, becomes sparse in certain areas.
The way things have changed with wild rice on the sloughs, has it created stress as far as how much people collect or how they manage wild rice?
Yeah, so some communities have rice chiefs that spend a lot of time out on these different water bodies monitoring the minumen, and then they'll actually let the community know when it's time to open those lakes up for ricing. Our community has a rice committee, which operates very similarly, in that this rice committee, you know, goes out and visits the minumen, you know, checks on the various stages, and then gives recommendations to our natural resources department, which then open up certain areas along the waterways, you know, and so when it opens this time of the year, it's usually not all open at once. They'll open up certain areas within the sloughs, put up, you know, stop signs, stop markers, and then open up the rest when the rest is ready, because sometimes it doesn't always all ripen at once. So that's one thing that our community does, and they do pretty well. Our rice committee is usually comprised of some of our elders or really, you know, well-experienced ricers within the community, and then sometimes a few young people that are, you know, learning the ways of that minumen.
So how is the season looking right now?
The feedback we've been getting is it's been pretty good out there. You know, like I said, every year is different, and everybody has certain areas that they go to out there that it kind of dictates how somebody might feel about it. You know, in some of their spots it might be good this year compared to last year, and other spots it might be, you know, vice versa. And so it really depends on where you go out in the sloughs. It's a really big area.
What are the chief concerns then for the tribe related to wild rice and how to manage that?
So as a tribal leader, and as tribal leaders in this community, we're always worried about what's going on upstream, you know, things that could potentially impact us downstream, because, you know, everything, you know, that flows down this way, and you look at the topography of the area and you look at the wetlands and the dense water estuaries in this area, everything flows that way. And so that minumen is like that last stronghold out there before we get into Lake Superior. And so we're always very concerned and, I guess, adept to what's going on upstream and how that might impact minumen. We're always kind of keeping an eye on weather extremes, like I said, flooding and heavy rainfall. And then invasive species sometimes can be an issue, like purple loosestrife. That's a, you know, an exotic plant that has taken over a lot of areas in our traditional ricing spots. Sometimes you worry about imbalance within the ecosystems. You know, a lot of our elders talk about those red-winged blackbirds and rice worms and all the spiders and all the microorganisms that exist within that ecosystem, and how, you know, the the diminishment of one of those populations, you know, could mean some severe imbalance within the Manuman, which can cause problems. And so.
So are you, or is the tribe trying to do things right now to control invasive species to help wild rice?
We have technicians that go out there quite often throughout the year, and they'll hand pull a lot of exotic species out of some of our Manuman beds. So we have that. A couple years ago, the Fond du Lac band was really gracious in allowing us to use one of their airboats they had devised up with some cutters on the back that, you know, kind of, they don't harm anything. They don't harm any Manuman, but they target some of those exotics and invasive species in there as well and pull those out.
So how do you think that this season compares to previous season, the way it looks right now?
A few years ago when we had that massive flood, you know, the rice was really, it was difficult to rice that year. It wasn't very good from my recollection, but it seemed like the following year it turned out to be really, really good. People were concerned. You know, it causes stress within people in our community because a lot of our people depend upon that Manuman. You know, when we're harvesting for ourselves, our families, our extended kinship, and that Manuman gets utilized throughout the whole year. So you're out there harvesting those, you know, couple of weeks, and that's going to get you by through the season, and that's how we subsist upon that. So, you know, a bad year could mean, you know, less Manuman that your family eats, less healthy food staples for that whole year. So last year, you know, I thought it was actually pretty good, and I think a lot of people agreed that something within that flood might have stirred up a lot of minerals and nutrients that helped that Manuman in the long run. And so, you know, I think we saw a pretty decent year last year, and I think we're hoping for another decent year this year.
Well, that's interesting to hear that it might have helped the Manuman, because I think a lot of people feel like flooding is what's hurting it in the short term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that in general, we're always really quick to, you know, put these negative connotations on some of these things that happen. But, you know, as Anishinaabe people, we're really resilient. We make things work, and we believe that there's, you know, sometimes there's good that comes out of some of these things that happen.
They tend to fluctuate from year to year because, like Bij Kins was saying, our rice is really sensitive to a lot of different factors. And a lot of elders, you know, from here and from different communities as well, have noticed that there's around a four-year cycle for Manuman. And you hear about that a lot too, that one year it'll be really great and really awesome, and it will produce a lot of rice for our harvesters and our families, but also for the waterfowl and all the other beings that depend on that rice. But maybe the next year it might not be so well. And I just wanted to mention that they always talk about maybe like a four-year cycle and fluctuation with the abundance of Manuman in various places.
You were talking before about traditional ecological knowledge. Do you feel that people are still harvesting wild rice with that traditional aspect to it, or are there new ways that are being used now to harvest wild rice?
A lot of our harvesters are still going out there in a very traditional and a very good way, you know, the best way that we know how. And I also wanted to add that some of our concerns as Anishinaabe people is when people harvest maybe not in the best way, and that can really damage the rice and the plant itself, and that decreases the rice abundance in the long run, because you're damaging the plant. And like as we've said, it's a very sensitive being for a lot of ways, but humans can also damage it and affect its productivity of the seed itself.
You said that there's been a lot of work on developing a wild rice plan, and that you're working on sharing that knowledge with tribes right now, member tribes of Glyphwic. Mm-hmm. So what are you hoping comes out of that, and what's being worked on in the meantime?
In the meantime, we're still waiting to meet on it internally with Inglewick to discuss, editing the document and presenting it to the tribes in the future. That's what we're working on as of now. But my hopes personally is to generate a lot of really good discussion among Glyphwic member tribes and tribal representatives and harvesters who are out there and really concerned for Manoomin. So I would really love to have that meeting with everybody and have that discussion and hear where we can go from here, essentially.
And we're here at the powwow grounds, and you guys are getting ready to celebrate the Manoomin. Is it Manoomin harvest, or just celebrate wild rice in general?
Our powwow always falls around the time of harvest, and that's what we say. We're here to celebrate Manoomin, here to celebrate wild rice and everything that it gives to us, because it gives us life. So essentially what we're here doing is celebrating life, celebrating our people and our survival, and celebrating that beautiful plant that has brought us to this place and kept us here and kept us alive for so long. Manoomin is utilized in all of our ceremonies, all of our feasts, all of our doings, and it has a really big role in those doings. And what a lot of our elders will say is, a lot of our ceremonies, that's a given. Manoomin has to be there for that, because that's what our ancestors fed upon, and that's what we were given as Anishinaabeg to survive. And so we honor that one, and we utilize that one still to this day.
So what do you want people to know about wild rice, as you're celebrating it, as you're getting ready to harvest it throughout the season?
I think if people listened to this and maybe had a newfound respect for Manoomin and could walk away and understand a little better and hopefully understand that the tribal communities throughout the state and throughout the region are really working hard to preserve it all over the place so that it's here for everybody's benefit. I would hope that people understand all of the important health and nutritional benefits that Manoomin brings. It's one of the most healthiest things you can eat, that you can feed your children. And just understand that, we don't take Manoomin lightly. We do all that we can to protect that beautiful sacred plant. Our communities are set where they're at. Our people can't pick up and leave, and so we do the best we can to protect and maintain this place and take care of what we do have. And it all gets back to that relationship that we have with Manoomin and with everything in creation. And it's a relationship of reciprocity. We're always giving and taking. There's that back and forth, making that offering. And that's why when that Manoomin is harvested, just like when we harvest fish, just like when we harvest deer, it's not only just going to our families, but it's spread throughout the community. We donate it to feasts, we give it to our elders, we feed our people, literally. And that's part of that bigger picture and that bigger way of understanding how we need to be as just good human beings.
So do you feel like there's anything specific that could be done to better protect wild rice?
There are a lot of places and a lot of people that don't like Manoomin growing near them. A lot of, people that live on the lakes and, owners of property on the lake that, might consider it to be a weed of some sort, and it gets in the way of recreational, recreational boats and other sports, other watercraft, vessels. And so some people don't like that, and they do their best to destroy that Manoomin or to fight it, if it's going to be reseeded. And so I think our broader message is to learn a little bit more about Manoomin, eat Manoomin, harvest Manoomin, and understand it a little better before you know, taking that kind of action against it.
Again, you were just listening to Dylan Jennings with the Bad River Tribe and Emily Nellis with Glyphwic. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear from Glyphwic wildlife biologist Peter David about what the wild rice crop looks like in northern Wisconsin this year. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we're talking about wild rice and the effects that climate change are having on the crop and heavy rainfalls in the state. Up next, we hear from Glyphwic wildlife biologist Peter David. I spoke with him this morning about what the wild rice crop looks like right now in northern Wisconsin and how that compares to what we've seen in years past.
There's kind of interesting waves of abundance across the state. If you start over at the far east, Forest County area is actually pretty good, impressively good. But as you jump just a little bit further west into Oneida Vilas County, the crop is quite poor. Water levels are really apparently high. Even on the aerial surveys, you'd see sort of a ring of dead trees around many wetlands or lakes from the water that's been so high all summer. But then you jump over to Hayward area, and things are not too bad in that area. And you move a little bit further into Burnett and Douglas County, and it's sort of choppy, a real mix of abundance over there. We did sadly have the loss of the Radigan flowage in that area. Douglas County was a real jewel of a rice bed that was lost in the June storm that took out the dikes there. Then you move down to like Polk County, which is another rice part of Wisconsin, and the crop there looks pretty good, but we actually have concerns potentially about disease outbreaks there, particularly brown spot disease, which is a fungal disease that seems to be popping up more and more in the rice beds. So overall, certainly a below average year, and that's tough because it's really on the heels of a pretty poor season last year.
Really, because I was just talking with Dylan Jennings at Bad River, and he said that last year turned out to be okay.
You know, and one of the interesting things about rice is kind of as I just described, that there's so much variability along the landscape. And even this year, there's going to be sort of individual areas that are going to be okay or even very good.
Okay, so overall in northern Wisconsin, it's below average as far as the crop goes.
Yeah.
So is it the rain that we've been seeing the last several years that's really having an impact? I mean, you mentioned the Radigan flowage dam.
The dam there created a flowage that really supported some beautiful rice beds. And, you know, rice is not that common across the landscape, so that when a place like Radigan blinks out, that when that flowage drains and disappears, we lost maybe 1% of sort of the rice abundance in northern Wisconsin. And it seems like those events are happening more and more often. And even though 1% doesn't sound like very much, when you get one or two or three of those a year and you get 4 or 5 years in a row like that, then you're starting to have some pretty significant losses in the long term. In the short term, some of it, I think, is probably just the amount of rain we've had and high water levels. Our rice crops are usually best in more droughty years. But then when you have major impacts like you do at Radigan, you know, if we don't get repairs there, that bed's going to be lost forever, regardless of what happens down the line. But rice seems to be one of these plants that really is sensitive to climatic changes. And, you know, Manoman and the Ojibwe really understand how giving this plant is. And there's this understanding that if we take care of rice, it really takes care of us. And it certainly provides seed directly to us, but it also provides for so many other components of the ecological community out there, the fur bearers and the waterfowl and other species that also we really benefit from. And it's these years, it's just starting to feel like we're not really keeping our side of the bargain on there and taking care of the plant. And as a result, we're really hurting ourselves because it has less ability to take care of us.
So is there any time that you can remember in the past where you feel like things were starting to turn and you were seeing some of the effects that wild rice is contending with right now?
You know, it's been this sort of incremental climb, I think, or decline, I should say, where you feel like things are adding up. But climate being one of the biggest ones, you know, the heavy rainfall events are one. This brown spot disease that I mentioned is something that early in my career was something of an anomaly. It happened now and then here and there. The abundance of that seems to be increasing, you know, over time in a fairly marked way. And it's a fungal disease. It's something that is enhanced by warm, wet, humid conditions. And, of course, our summers are getting warmer all the time, it seems like. And then these storm events, boy, across the state today, just listening to the news this morning about all the tornadoes, all of their in the forecast in the week ahead here in the state, that's also, frankly, a challenge in itself, because you could have a good rice bed, but if these storms come through at the wrong time, you might get very little human harvest out of it, at least. And so those storms can have an effect, whether they happen early in the season or late.
Well, I was just wondering what you expect as far as the season moving forward and people harvesting. Do you think some lakes will be closed altogether, or?
You know, we are going to have a high number of the date-regulated lakes will not open this year, a higher number certainly than normal. We always expect some of those to not open, but the number will be higher than normal this year. But that being said, you know, we still encourage people to get out and harvest. You know, I can talk about what a giving plant this is, but there's nothing like experiencing it to get out into the rice beds itself and really, really have the experience of what I'm talking about. And when you do that, I think you develop very quickly a real appreciation for all of the things that Manoman provides. And that's true whether you come home with 5 pounds of rice in your canoe or 50 or 200. So, you know, we still encourage people to get out there, enjoy the fall, enjoy the time in the rice beds. Just pick in a good way, be respectful to the rice and to the other ricers, and enjoy and appreciate this gift.
Well, and I asked Dylan, and I guess I'm just wondering what you think, if anything can be done to help the crop or you know, protect it from some of these changes that are taking place.
You know, some of it is very, very hard to protect. Again, there's a few things you could do, I think, with an investment in resources, places like Radigan, certainly if we can find the funds to rebuild that dike, and probably have to build it to a higher standard maybe than they've been built in the past to prevent these things from happening. The 100-year storm now seems to be coming, it seems to be becoming a 10 or 5-year kind of event. And so things that used to be built to withstand the 100-year storm, maybe that's not good enough anymore. Those can help, but, you know, climate change is a very big thing and has a lot of tentacles that can reach in and affect rice in different ways. And you can deal with a few of those, but you really kind of have to go to the root of the problem, I think, if you're going to protect rice for the long term.
Okay. Well, I guess, you know, the only other question I would have is just when's the last good year that you can remember?
But there isn't one that stands out in really even the last 6 or 8 years in Wisconsin, and that's kind of overdue. We expect, as I said, you know, good years and bad years. That's part of the natural cycle of rice. You really can't expect rice to be good every year. That's really contrary to the way it functions ecologically. But you do expect it to happen occasionally, and you know, hopefully that year is around the corner. But you know, with the high water levels, we seem to be in a cycle that makes it seem unlikely that we'll have a really good year very soon.
Well, is there anything else I'm missing that you want to add, Peter?
Always happy when people get out and share their observations with others and share them with us. We always do a harvest survey at the end of the year, and we appreciate that with Wisconsin we've got a very good database, thanks to the harvesters submitting the information about their season each year. And if you get a survey, we always are really appreciative of you sending that back.
Again, you were just listening to Peter David, wildlife biologist with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear from Steve Vavris, a senior scientist with the Nelson Institute Center for Climactic Research at UW-Madison. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. In this hour, we've been talking about wild rice and the impacts that climate change has had on the Great Lakes region crop. Up next, we hear from senior scientist Steve Vavris. He's with the Nelson Institute Center for Climactic Research at UW-Madison. He spoke with me yesterday about what's driving the increase of heavy rains across the state.
We've been seeing an upward trend in rainfall in much of Wisconsin, and we've been seeing an increase in heavy rainfalls, not just around the state, but around the whole country. Every region of the country has seen an increase in extreme rainfall over the last few decades, and we're certainly no exception. It does seem as if the past decade, starting in 2007, we've seen an exceptional number here in the state, in different parts of the state. And this past week, we've now had two major flooding events, one in Dane County, south central Wisconsin, and the other in western Wisconsin. And I just noticed that the records show that this is the wettest 5 years on record statewide, dating back to 1895. So this increase in extreme rainfall certainly fits that trend.
So what seem to be the factors that are playing a role then in these very wet years that we've been seeing recently?
Well, a couple of factors. Probably the biggest is that you need to have a high amount of humidity in the air, and we've certainly been having that this summer. And often when we get a southerly flow, getting moisture from the Gulf of Mexico, that's very favorable. It also, there's some research that indicates that we may be seeing even more moisture in Wisconsin due to the intensification of agriculture in Iowa and Illinois. And so that produces more evaporation, transpiration from crops, especially corn. And then that moisture gets blown over Wisconsin. And when conditions are right for heavy rainfall, there's more moisture to wring out of the atmosphere.
Really? I wouldn't have thought that would have played a role.
It's still being determined. There's some research on this, but I find the evidence fairly convincing. And it also coincides with an unusual trend that we've seen toward fewer hot days during the summer in the state. And that seems paradoxical considering the global climate and our Wisconsin climate has been warming overall, but we've been seeing fewer 90-degree days. And it's the records show that when we have heavy rainfall during the summer, wet summers, those tend to have not many hot days. And it's the dry summers that produce a lot of those 90 and even 100 degree days. And this year is no exception.
So what does this mean then as we look to the future? What can we expect from climate change, or what, you know, the differences that Wisconsin is seeing play out?
What we've seen this summer may be a harbinger of things to come in a couple of ways. The factors that created the really heavy rainfall that we saw in Dane County last week was attributable to two major factors. One, the humidity was exceptionally high, as it's been much of the summer. And the other was that there was a stalled weather system. So whether it be a front or a low pressure cell, when weather systems propagate slowly and they hang around for a while, then there's the potential for, in this case, heavy rainfall. And when you put the two factors together, like what happened a week ago Monday, the result is a double whammy, and we get this exceptional rainfall. The radar returns showed that the storm barely moved over the western part of the county, and so that's the reason why there was such extreme rainfalls on the order of 11 to 15 inches.
Okay. And well, you know, the conversation surrounding climate change right now seem to become more politicized as people have either sought to deny science and facts that have come out. There are groups of people that say, well, this is just cyclical and we need larger data sets to be able to tell whether or not things are actually changing. I mean, do you feel like that's the case, or do we have enough data to say that things are changing and it's not going to go back to the way it used to be?
Right. I think the latter. I think that maybe 20 years ago, someone could have used the argument that we don't have enough information, that we need to wait a little while longer to see. But the warming trend globally has been so pronounced and so consistent, and the expressions of climate change we're seeing in various parts of the world, including the Arctic, with the loss of huge amounts of ice cover, is just very, very clear evidence that the climate is warming. And precipitation is a little less obvious. We need to have good records to see whether there's been an increase in rainfall. but it's energetically what happens is when the atmosphere is warmer and the Earth's surface is warmer, there's more evaporation from the oceans and lakes and soil, and that leads to more moisture in the atmosphere, and more moisture in the atmosphere leads to an overall increase in rainfall globally or precipitation globally. And so that's all consistent with the records we've seen so far.
So based on everything that you've said then, what, if anything, can communities do to adapt to these changes, you know, especially as it relates to some of the flooding that we've seen in recent days and months?
Fortunately, there's a lot that communities can do, and it can be done at both the individual level and the community-wide level. So at the individual level, there's steps that people can take to stop or slow the rate of stormwater runoff into lakes and streams. These are things like some obvious ones, like keeping street gutters clear, directing your downspouts toward lawns instead of driveways, for example, creating rain gardens or rain barrels. And then the second part is to try to reduce the impact of the stormwater runoff that does get into the water bodies. And so these are things like removing leaves from streets, using less salt on your sidewalk and driveway, and picking up after your pets. So these are steps that reduce the pollutants that go into the lakes, and importantly, that reduces the phosphorus input into lakes and streams, and it's that phosphorus input that leads to these big bad algae blooms like we've seen during the summer. At a broader community level, governmental level, there are things that can be done that is useful for reducing stormwater runoff. One is simply enforcing ordinances that are on the books for stormwater retention. Another one is protecting wetlands. Wetlands are natural mitigators for floods as they slow the rate of flow across the landscape. Also using permeable pavement so that we get more of that rainfall that goes into groundwater instead of just rushing off into lakes and streams. And then a final step is working with the agricultural community to try to reduce manure runoff on farms. We're such a big dairy state, and that means a lot of manure. And there are some great steps that are being done right here locally, where I am in Dane County, the Dane County government, the city of Madison, and nonprofits like Clean Lakes Alliance and Yahara Pride Farms are working together to try to reduce the amount of runoff from farms. We all benefit from agriculture, and we all play a part in trying to solve this problem. And the more we can do to reduce that amount of phosphorus runoff from farms, the better everyone is.
Taking steps to work together and partner to meet some of these challenges that are facing communities.
Exactly. Rather than pointing fingers, this is something that a problem that we're all in together. And like I said, we all benefit from agriculture and we all benefit from clean lakes and streams. So this is something that we should work on collectively.
Well, I really appreciate your time on this. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you, Danielle.
Again, you were just listening to Steve Vavaris with the Nelson Institute Center for Climactic Research at UW-Madison. Over the last 6 years, northern Wisconsin has dealt with three floods that have caused millions of dollars in damage. Local, state, and federal stakeholders in the region have been trying to find ways to manage stormwater runoff and reduce the amount of sediment washing into Lake Superior. Not far from the area where U.S. Highway 2 washed out in June, Tom Gazdick leads the way to a roughly half-acre pond on the back of his property. His grandfather came here to farm in the early 1900s.
This was all dairy farms, so the cattle would graze in the forest. There would be trails all over, and it was ideal for raising cattle because there was a lot of water available.
But the water also made it difficult to farm, and many producers gave up growing crops or hay. Gazdick's father gave it up long ago. He says that made it an ideal spot for installing a wetland pond.
I grew up playing back here in all the springs and all that stuff, so I knew that this was ideal for a pond, and I always wanted to have some up here. And when I heard about this project, I'm going, oh my God, this is perfect.
Northland College in Ashland is working with landowners like Gazdick to slow the flow of runoff from heavy rains into North Fish Creek using money from the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Matt Hudson is associate director of the college's Center for Freshwater Innovation. He says wetland ponds could be part of the solution.
If we can hold back some of that water on the landscape, before it gets into the stream, we can reduce the amount of water that rushes into the stream at one time and reduce the amount of erosion that happens in the stream, and then reduce the amount of sediment that gets into Schwamingen Bay.
Has it gone down since the storm, Tom?
Yes.
Pond has? Okay.
But it's not always easy to get landowners on board. Travis Tulowitzki with Bayfield County Land and Water says they've done 8 ponds with 3 landowners.
Farmers, for the most part, do not want to give up their field. That's their livelihood. So if we can find areas that are kind of in that transition, it's not completely forested, and this is really an ideal site because it's still open. It has a lot of drainages that are going towards North Fish.
Tulowitzki says they're building these ponds to withstand 100-year floods.
Because of the tendency of our storms lately, we are pushing most everything for 100-year at least.
That's a flood that has a 1% chance of happening in any given year. If the pond overflows, that water runs into a rock-lined spillway. The rocks spread out and slow down water heading toward North Fish Creek. When heavy rains hit in June, Gazdick admits he was worried about whether his 4 ponds would hold.
Yeah, I was concerned, but everything worked out great.
A lot of this work stems from previous studies by the U.S. Geological Survey. They found North Fish Creek is already prone to flash floods and erosion. That's due in part to the region's clay soils and sandy deposits left over from receding glaciers. Heavy logging and farming at the turn of the 20th century made it even worse. Matt Hudson with Northland College says they want to reduce the impact people have on the land.
With changing climate and stuff like that, we want to promote a system that's more resilient if we're going to have more of these floods in the future.
Hudson says they're also working with a stream restoration firm to stabilize eroding banks by creating log jams in the creek. About 2/3 of the sediment that ends up in Shawangan Bay on Lake Superior comes from its large eroding banks. He hopes projects upstream with landowners and downstream in the creek will improve flood resilience, fish habitats, and water quality.
And it's helping with a public resource need in terms of improving Fish Creek and reducing sediment to the bay, which, affects the city of Ashland's drinking water and all the recreation and boating and charter fishing and all the people living in the Ashland area.
He says a little prevention may cut back on the threat floodwaters pose to their quality of life. And now it's time for a look back on some of the news of the week. The National Weather Service has confirmed an outbreak Tuesday of at least 16 tornadoes in east central Wisconsin. Several trees were uprooted and buildings were damaged. No injuries were reported. Recovery efforts continue in multiple communities after recent storms brought torrential rainfalls to several parts of the state, causing flooding. Some areas have seen rainfalls of up to 14 inches in the last 2 weeks, causing lake levels to rise in Dane County and pushed portions of the Kickapoo and Baraboo rivers to record levels. People in towns along the Baraboo River were evacuated on Thursday. Members of the Wisconsin National Guard assisted with sandbagging operations in North Freedom and Baraboo. Governor Scott Walker has plans to discuss flood damage in Sauk County today. A group of states and businesses announced a campaign on Thursday to draw cruise ships to the Great Lakes. One cruise line is already planning trips that will visit Wisconsin ports next summer. States like Wisconsin, Canadian provinces, ports, and tourism agencies are partnering to promote cruise ship tourism in the region. Bruce Nierenberg with Florida-based Victory Cruise Lines says they're planning up to 40 trips in 2019.
We're going to be visiting all 5 lakes. Matter of fact, we're starting a cruise schedule into Lake Superior in 2019 at Victory that's going to feature Thunder Bay and Duluth, and we're going to be going to Wisconsin ports like Sturgeon Bay and Green Bay and Milwaukee.
Visit Duluth CEO and President Anna Tansky says Victory Cruise Lines has 2 scheduled trips next year that will bring in around 1,000 visitors. She says a cruise ship hasn't visited the Twin Ports in 5 years.
And now there is definitely a renewed interest in the unique offerings of Lake Superior, primarily because there has been such significant growth and interest in Great Lakes cruising overall.
The Duluth Economic Development Authority, Duluth City Council, and Duluth Seaway Port Authority will contribute around $85,000 to build a temporary facility to process international passengers through customs. A spokeswoman with the Wisconsin Department of Tourism says they're reviewing what state ports need to accommodate cruise ships and travelers. The Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development Authority, or WEDA, awarded more than $500,000 to fund renovations at two affordable housing developments in Superior on Thursday. WEDA provided roughly $538,000 in state housing tax credits for work on Regina Hills and Clifford Lund apartments in the city. The agency said in a news release that the funding will help preserve 158 affordable housing units in Superior. The repairs at the two apartment complexes will include replacing roofs, doors, windows, and more. The project was one of 15 applications for funding that the agency received. WEDA is awarding around $7 million in state housing tax credits across Wisconsin for similar projects. Several groups representing cities, towns, and counties recently launched a campaign to push lawmakers to close the so-called dark store loophole. Big box stores say the property taxes they pay should be measured like similar vacant or dark stores. Jerry Deschaine with the Wisconsin League of Municipalities says that reasoning doesn't make sense because large retailers aren't dark properties.
That would be like me assessing your house as if it were foreclosed, abandoned, and boarded up. These are active, growing, thriving businesses on busy street corners in downtown Wisconsin. They're being valued at what they're actually worth, not what theoretically they would be worth if they were vacant.
Corden Fish with Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce says that argument is like saying one home is worth more than an identical vacant house nearby because a family lives there.
And I think any rational buyer would find that absurd, that you have two identical properties, two identical homes, and one's worth more solely because you're living in it. And they're not only arguing that it's worth more on the open market because you're living in it, they're arguing that you should pay more taxes.
Deschaine says they want lawmakers to close the loophole that he says allows big box stores to shift the property tax burden onto homeowners and small businesses. Two bills that would have closed the so-called loophole failed this year despite bipartisan support. And that's some of the news of the week, and that's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You can also find us on iTunes under Hear Me Out. You've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great holiday weekend.